I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. That's a scene from director Terry Gilliam's Time Bandits, featuring Sean Connery as Agamemnon dueling a large and scary minotaur-looking fighter. Mary Nara says that seeing that movie inspired her first trip to Greece and her long love affair with everything Greek. Her new book, Greek to Me, is part travelogue, part memoir, and part celebration of language and mythology. She writes how she has identified with Athena and how Sophocles' Antigone, quote, helped me cope with my own role in a changing family after the death of her brother. Her previous best-selling book, Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen, was about her many years as a copy editor at The New Yorker. Now, listeners posted some of their questions and complaints about grammar and punctuation on the Radio Times Facebook page, which we will get to. But first, Greece. And Mary Norris, a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's wonderful to be here and in Philadelphia, Marty.
Absolutely. Was it something about Sean Connery? I mean, we should say Time Bandits, of course, breaks all the historical rules. But what was it about Time Bandits?
Well, it was partly Sean Connery, I admit. But it was mainly the scenery behind Sean Connery, the land and the sky and the sharpness of the elements that made me immediately want to go to this place.
Although it wasn't Greece, right?
It wasn't filmed in Greece. No, it turned out it was shot in Morocco. So I went on a 30-year detour.
But when you got to Greece, and you write about kind of the first trip there, just being voracious, frankly, about getting from one point to the other, did it meet your expectations?
Oh, it more than met my expectations. I refused to go on a cruise where the places were, you know, where everything was organized for me. So I had to catch my own ferries and make my way from one point to another. And it was sometimes frustrating because those ships don't always come in on time. But the more frustration, the more the glory of boarding the boat and going on to the next place.
So was it everything? I mean, was it, as you mentioned, the landscapes, the food, the art, the culture, the people? I'm thinking the culture, the mythology. I mean, everything that is in Greece.
Yes, it really was everything. The sea was a huge part of it. The colors of the Aegean Sea and the horizons were always so wonderful to rest my eyeballs on, you know, as a proofreader. So I was taking a rest from looking at everything 14 inches from my eyes, and I wanted to expand my eyes. It felt great. It was beautiful.
How, on your first trip, how good was your Greek?
My Greek was pretty terrible. I made lots of mistakes. I was good enough to buy a ticket on a ferry and get food in a restaurant. Of course, you don't need much Greek for that. Get a hotel room, ask, does the elevator work? Liturgie? Does it work? Of course it works. I couldn't do small talk, but I could do the basics.
You say, think of Greek letters as characters, which I thought, I know nothing about the Greek language, but I thought, what an interesting entree into understanding a language and an alphabet so different from ours.
Well, I racked my brain to find a way to make the alphabet interesting. You can't just list the letters in alphabetical order and give an example without getting very bored. So I thought of the fraternity system, right, and Phi Beta Kappa and those big letters outside of fraternity houses, and began to think of them as characters. You know, that word means a letter or a piece of punctuation or some unit in a tweet, for instance, 140 characters.
Right.
And it also means personality. There's, you know, the connection between the metaphorical meaning and the concrete meaning is really interesting. So that was one of the ways I tried to get people to feel less fear of the Greek alphabet.
You also say about the Greek language that it, quote, seems to exalt the everyday.
Oh, I think it does. The first word I learned was ilios, which means sun. And to make the connection to remember that, I thought of the English word helios comes right from the Greek for the sun god. And what to us is the sun god in Greece is the everyday word still for the sun. Mm. So it makes you... It turns you into a bit of a sun worshiper, for one thing, and then it exalts everything. Everything feels like it has a little divinity in it.
You also talk about the fact that the alphabet is the greatest invention of humankind. Hard to argue with that. But we have to thank the Greeks for giving us vowels. I guess before Greek, there were no vowels.
Yes, the Greeks took their alphabet from the Phoenicians. They used it just for trade, you know, mainly to keep inventories, I think, and make sure that people got their goods. And the Greeks adapted that alphabet. They say it was Cadmus, a prince of Phoenicia, who brought the alphabet to Thebes. And the genius of the Greeks was that they added characters for the vowels.
Hmm.
You know, there's a trend right now to do without vowels.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah.
I have noticed that,
yeah.
Yes.
I see there's in New York, there's an ambulance that's spelled AMBULNZ. You know, as if it was fun to get into one of these things, an ambulance. I guess you can tell I disapprove a little because.
Well, I was going to say, and are you being disapproving, Mary Norris?
I love the vowels. The vowels really are the breath of the language itself, and having them represented in the alphabet is a good thing.
You also talk about just, I guess, early Greek, there wasn't spacing, so there were no sentences, I guess, as we would recognize them.
There were sentences, but all the words were crushed together. No space between words, no periods at the end of the sentence, no punctuation, all capital letters. Mm-hmm. So basically, you really had to work it out, or better yet, know what it said before you came to read it. I bet that's how it started, because it was an oral culture.
Originally. It's interesting to think of capital letters today, which is the same as yelling. I mean, capital letters in print, especially on something like Twitter, is you're yelling at the person.
Yes, or you're giving emphasis to something that would not ordinarily have that emphasis, self-importance to a word. You know, well, capitals still have wonderful function that way, yes.
I'm also curious about just how you saw, and I guess even heard then, the language. Would you say modern Greek may be a dying language?
Well, I worry about it. I don't think there's any danger of its dying, because the Greeks have been around for so long and the Greeks will continue to keep their culture up. It gets harder for me to practice modern Greek because so many Greeks know English. And when you travel there, if their English is better than my Greek, of course I go with English. And you see more signs in Athens of not just English, but in fact languages from all the countries where people are emigrating from, or the refugees,
right.
And the tourists from all over Asia. So it's not just Greek in the signs
of
Athens.
I mean, I've just came back from Puerto Rico, and things are in English and in Spanish.
Right.
I mean, it's just I remember going to Ireland and seeing them in, you know, in a language I didn't even recognize.
So Irish Gaelic, yes.
Yeah, the Gaelic, exactly.
Yes. Long words, because they don't have a lot of consonants, so they use consonant clusters for very simple sounds.
You talk about the study of Greek was, quote, my therapy in those days, my relief from my native tongue and the pressures at work. How so?
Well, it was the 80s. I was on the copy desk of the New Yorker, and it was not an easy job, especially at first. It took a good year to learn not just the rules, but how rigidly to apply them or not. And I was always worried that I was going to get yelled at. There were some kind of harsh mentors there. There was one woman named Lou Burke who actually threw a dictionary at someone's head once.
What was the infraction, do you know?
Well, it was somebody who was working proofreading while listening to the radio with earphones on, and Lou Burke couldn't believe anyone could concentrate on her work while wearing headphones. And in fact, this person, my friend Lindsley, would never have been doing that, but it was the last radio broadcast of someone named Dr. Demented, I think.
The perfect thing to listen to when you're proofreading, right, or copy editing. But the pressure, I guess, of being, what, correct?
Not just of being correct, but of being appropriate. It was bad enough to let something slide through, you know, the difference between principal with an L-E and principal with an A-L. There are still things I have blind spots for.
Really?
And there was the misspelling of chaise longue that I let go through as chaise lounge, which is how we said it in Ohio. You know, And somebody wrote in about that and said, is this, are the glory days of the New Yorker gone forever? And this same person, Lou Burke, put a note on that saying, they sure are, and distributed this around the office.
Oh, my God.
So I didn't sleep well that night. But, you know, the world didn't end.
No.
It was
no.
all over the next day.
I remember, actually, in elementary school, between the principal and principal,
yes.
who ran, and someone said, well, the principal is your pal, P-A-L. And forever, that just stayed in my head.
Uh-huh. I can't even think now, but the principal of the thing, that's an L-E, right?
Yes.
A rule.
Oh, I'm so
principal.
Glad to hear you struggle with this, because we just assume you know everything.
Ooh. Uh-oh.
I'm curious about also just how the Greek mythology, and what I found so interesting in your book is are there have been moments in your life where understanding and even identifying with a story or a character, so to speak, has really helped you through life?
It really has. And once I decided to go to Greece and I started studying Greek, I also started reading the classics in translation. And I remembered that in college, when I was a sophomore, I took a course in mythology. This was at Douglas College in Rutgers. Mm-hmm. The professor was Froma Zeitlin, who has since become really famous, but she was still starting out then. And she was a brilliant lecturer. And I am a devotee of Athena. But yes. The first story that really, really got me at that age was Demeter and Persephone. Mm-hmm. Demeter, the mother, and losing Persephone to Hades. She was, Persephone was raped, born, and died all at the same time, you know, because she died, but she was born as the queen of the underworld. And then the wonderful thing about her coming back in the spring and having to die again in the fall, but always coming back in the spring, you know, it's very sad, but it's also full of redemption. And that myth really moved me.
Why?
Because it's full of hope, and it's also sad, and it is a comfort about the human condition. You know, when before they really knew how things worked, in the winter, people must have been afraid that the spring would never come. And I have that feeling every year.
I
it seems like,
well.
You know, March, April, it's not here yet. I think we're finally there, safe for this year.
That's Mary Norris, our guest on Radio Times today. She's got a new book. It's called Greek to Me, Adventures of the Comma Queen. And the Comma Queen is the name, I guess, she gave herself from her many years as a copy editor at The New Yorker. And we are talking about her experiences, her adventures in Greece, and also some interesting comments and explorations of Greek language, Greek words. We will be talking about things like commas later in the show. You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone. Mary Norris is our guest. Again, her new book is called Greek to Me, Adventures of the Comma Queen. And she told me during the break that it was her agent that came up with the branding of Mary Norris as the Comma Queen. One of the things that she writes in her book, Greek to Me, is about going to the movies as a kid. And one of the movies she saw was Ulysses, starring Kirk Douglas. Here's the trailer.
Ulysses! Ulysses, starring Kirk Douglas as the mightiest of warriors, mightiest of lovers. In this mightiest of motion pictures, Ulysses! Only a great star like Kirk Douglas could portray so great a hero. Thrill as Ulysses dares the hideous one-eyed Cyclops. Gasp at the black magic of Circe the Enchantress, who turns Ulysses and his men into swine.
Give me back my men, goddess, demon, witch, or whatever you are.
Marvel at the tremendous spectacle of the Trojan War. Ulysses and his warriors springing from the mammoth wooden horse to overwhelm the walls of Troy. See Ulysses live his fantastic adventures again. Filmed where they actually happened 5,000 years ago. The 1,001 thrills of Ulysses, the greatest of all adventurers, mightiest of all warriors. biggest of all motion pictures, Ulysses!
Such a subtle trailer for this 1954 movie starring Kirk Douglas as Ulysses. You remember, though?
It comes right back to me. Actually, I was just thinking of sitting in the Lyceum Theater with the shared box of popcorn that our older brother would buy. He sat between us, and we were only allowed one kernel at a time, and we had to have it chewed and swallowed before reaching for another. He was a harsh man.
This was your brother.
Yes.
but something about that, and I remember seeing, Sinbad movies and all, movies of
yes,
that time that
yes.
were just... probably historically completely incorrect, but so enthralling in Technicolor, too.
Yes, they were so big and so thrilling and full of monsters. That really was the heyday of that kind of thing, wasn't it?
Let me ask you about some of the things, some of the letters that you write about that you like so much, one being, is it PSI? Psi.
Psi.
Psi. Yes. You describe Psi as your favorite Greek letter.
Well, it gave us such words as psychology and all of the words with psychoanalysis and mm-hmm. psychosis and psychopath. Mm-hmm. And that psi, I think in Roman languages, in the Romance languages, they still pronounce the P, like psychology. And in Greek, it was psyche, P-S-Y-C-H-E. Who was, I think the word meant something like soul, spirit, and she was the bride of Eros, which is erotic love, who was the son of Aphrodite. Right. So a tempering influence, I think, the mind on all of the physical things.
So interesting. You also deconstruct the word Amazon, of course, the tribe of women warriors. Take apart the word Amazon, what that means and what it reveals really to us.
Well, it's actually folk etymology, but the word is amazos, and a is that, I think it's called the privative a. It means the opposite of something. So it's without a breast, Amazon. And the legend is that in order for the women who all lived by themselves and they only met men to procreate on a certain schedule once a year, in order to shoot bow and arrow better, they removed the right breast of the girls. They cauterized the breast so it wouldn't grow.
Wow.
And that made them better archers.
And they have to worry about the breast being in the way of pulling the
right.
bow back,
yes.
I guess.
You don't, well, if you had a right breast, you would hurt it while you were shooting, or you would run that risk.
I love things like that. I mean, whether they're true or not, as you say, mm-hmm, more maybe
yes.
a folk legend, but who cares, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. I love those things, too. And the fact that the Amazons have come down to us as examples of strong, independent warrior women, they're good horseback riders. And, the reason that Jeff Bezos picked the name Amazon was for the river because it was big, but the river was named for the Amazons because there was a tribe in that area where the women were warriors along with the men, and that information was sent back to the king of the country, of the guys who were exploring it, probably Spaniards.
Is your love for Greek, or certainly the Greek language, in that it is a way of understanding our own English language?
Truly, truly it is. All of those words, there's a lot of medical specialties. One of my favorite words, even before I came to study Greek, was otorhinolaryngologist.
Say it again.
Otorhinolaryngologist. Right. Oto is ear, rhino is nose, like the rhinoceros. That means nose head. And larynx, laryngology, of course. And ology, logos, is the word, the study, the lore behind something. And I used to think that otorhinolaryngologist, being formed from Greek roots, was an actual word from antiquity. And then suddenly I realized, oh, no, they probably did not have ENTs in ancient Greece.
Right,
the Demosthenes used pebbles in his mouth. He didn't study with a speech therapist necessarily. So those words were put together from Greek roots around Victorian times when those kind of specialties came into being.
which just tells you about just how language gets sort of reconfigured and put together. And
yes, and it's interesting that they go back to Greek for those roots. And I think it's because the Greek straddles all of the languages, or many of them, English and German, and all the Romance languages too. Latin has so much from Greek, so that the one word will work in all those languages.
You mentioned Latin, and you write in your book that your dad did not want you to study Latin.
No, Dad was basically against education for women, I'm afraid.
Really?
But he had also been scarred in his youth. He had an uncle who went to the seminary, was going to be a Jesuit, and then decided against it, but not until after he had gotten a classical education. And he went back to Canada and farmed pigs. And my father, as a teenager, was a bit of a delinquent. And he got in some trouble in the neighborhood, and rather than have him go to jail or something like that, my grandmother had him sent to her brother's on the farm in Ontario. And this Uncle Jim was always forcing stories from mythology on my father. Sysyphus was one that made quite an impression.
I would think so, right. The never-ending rolling of the rock up the hill or the mountain.
My father would tell us about Sysyphus, I don't know why, just to so that we'd lower our expectations for life or something. But he thought that that stuff, because it was a punishment for him, would turn out to be a punishment for me, I think.
You regret that? I mean, as a lover of language?
Yes, I would have had a different grip on the whole thing if I'd studied Latin when I was young.
Mm-hmm.
I can still try to study it now when I'm old, but I can also still try to study Chinese, you know, or Dutch. There seems to be a lot to choose from. I do still want to study Latin, though.
Mm. Were you, though, a kid that obviously loved language?
I was deep into books. You know, they were my great escape. And really, I think the delving into Greek in my 30s was kind of the equivalent of that, a place where I could just lose myself. You know, I always had a mystery book with me as a kid. I remember that there was one book that had French characters in it, and it had the word O-U-I in it.
Huh.
And I puzzled. It sounded like something a pig would say, oi.
Yeah.
But I did finally deduce that it meant yes.
Words to live by, right? Saying yes. You also write about the fact that you did connect with Athena. I mean, that seemed like she had something to tell you as a young woman, or maybe even a girl.
Yes, I had not that many models growing up. You know, of course, every girl looks at her mother and thinks she's going to grow up to be like her mother and take care of babies and sweep the carpet. Mm-hmm. And that only went a certain way. And I had two brothers, and they never had to sweep the carpet or do anything like that. And I was very envious of that. And then I went to Catholic school, and there were the nuns. So they were another kind of a model. And at some point, it became clear to me that besides being married or being a nun, you could be a single woman.
Right.
It seemed at that point, back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, like that was still the old maid, and that wasn't a choice. That was just something, you know, you just ended up on the shelf. So it was when I got to the New Yorker that I began to know women who were single, who had strong personalities and good careers and good lives. And I thought of Athena as a good model, really, for a copy editor, because she was so strong that she wouldn't let anyone push her around, and she'd be devoted to the purity of the language. And that's really what I tried to do. I tried to, you know, leave out my own ego about things, realize that whether I liked the writer or not, this was my job to improve the writing, and stay true to the language.
And Athena as your sort of guide through that.
Yes, somebody who would not get angry. You know, I had mentors who were always popping off. And who was strategic in getting the right thing done, you know, instead of just trying to enforce her will. Or, you know, Greeks are like that. Greeks aren't direct.
Hmm.
You know, you say, hey, I would like to study in your university. I would like to teach the kids. I would like to move there. You can't do that. You have to find some way to make it seem like a good idea to them.
Huh. Sort of a backdoor way of persuading somebody. Yes. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Mary Norris, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. A couple of years ago, she wrote Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen, about her many years as a copy editor at The New Yorker. And we're talking about her new book. It's called Greek to Me, Adventures of the Copy, Adventures of the Comma Queen. And it's about her, frankly, her love affair with just about all things Greek, and her numbers of trips to Greece, what she has learned, and how that has helped her understand language, frankly, and herself. You do write about a tragic thing that happened in your family. You had a brother who was, about 3 or 4 years old?
Just almost three.
Almost 3 years old, who choked on a piece of bacon and died. I mean, I read that. Horrifying to think here you are around the breakfast table, right?
Yes, I was only one, so, you know, I don't have a direct memory of it, but my mother talked about it all the while that we were growing up. That was her therapy. You know, she needed somebody to talk to about it, so she told us the story over and over and over again, and I internalized it, and I felt guilty. I thought it was my fault. Oh, you know, the story.
Even though you were just 1 year old.
Yeah, well, the story was that he wanted his bacon, and my mother told him, wait, I'll cut that up for you. I need to feed the baby. So that was me, and so I've always had food issues.
Really? Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. I mean,
okay. It's a lot better. So it's very hard to talk about. Writing that chapter, it was the hardest thing to write. Every time I copy edited or proofread it or had to reread it for any reason, I had to leave the rest of the day free because I was not good for anything else.
Oh.
But I do want to say that when you get past that chapter, it is all sweetness and light.
No question. And I don't mean to put you through something making you feel uncomfortable talking about it, but I just wanted to add one more thing was that as you write, Sophocles' Antigone helped me cope with my own role in a changing family. So once again, turning to Greek mythology to help you understand your place in the family, but also perhaps even understand your parents' grief.
Well, you know, that's what tragedy was in ancient Greece. It was therapy. It was their form of therapy. So, you know, anything that happened to Antigone, nothing that bad has happened to me as what happened to Antigone. So it would always make me feel better. Mm-hmm. In that instance about Antigone, my little brother became my sister. And the way that will feel to somebody who has a transgender person in the family is you're losing. It's almost as if that brother died because somebody suddenly was trying to replace him. And I wasn't ready for that. So, you know, it just felt like another death in the family. And I happened to be reading Antigone in ancient Greek at the time, and it was balm to me. Oh. It really helped me understand what was going on. It helped me express my sadness about it, and it helped me move on.
Right. Which is what, you know, a great myth can do, right?
Yes.
When it connects so emotionally and so viscerally.
And it makes you realize that there's nothing new under the sun. Mm-hmm. You know, no matter what happens to you, how odd it is, how modern it might seem, the Greeks knew about it and they had a myth for it.
You say something rather provocative in this book about Greece that, and I'm scrambling here for my little notes, I was more in love with Greek than it was with me. And you've been there numerous times. But
I have. And I think my modern Greek peaked early. You know, I started by studying modern Greek, and then I studied ancient Greek, and I went back and forth, and I got them pretty muddled. And, you know, I can still pull it out when I have to, but I will never give up. But the difficulty of actually having a serious conversation with anyone in Greek, of understanding, of being able to eavesdrop. I would love to be able to eavesdrop in Greek, but that's one of the hardest things there is to do. So, yes, I do love it. I love listening to it. It's a dancing language, the way the stresses are always moving. And yet I don't – well, the point is really that I will never be Greek.
Right. Was that your goal?
In a way it was, yes.
So disappear into
Greece? To be reborn
in
the form of a Greek. And so, okay, that didn't work out. For a while, I thought if I married a Greek and had a child, I could raise the child in Greek along with the man, and that would be about as close as I could get.
You do, though, describe in just the most sort of glorious, sensual detail about swimming naked.
Well,
you know, sometimes naked, sometimes not, but just swimming in the waters of Greece.
Yes, that's, you're reminding me of the chapter in the book that's about going to Cyprus in search of the baths of Aphrodite. I'd heard a legend that if there was one beach, if you swam out around these rocks, you would be beautiful forever. So I went there. I found my way to this beach all by myself, and I had the beach all to myself on the north shore of Cyprus. Actually, not that far north because I guess it being divided. This was in a part of Greek Cypriot Cyprus. So I took a dip in there and I got out to the rocks, and I didn't want to make the mistake that Thetis made when she dipped Achilles in the river and made him immortal except for his heel. So I did take off my bathing suit and skinny dipped around this beach and around these rocks, and then swam back to the shore. And I don't know if I was more beautiful, but everything that I saw when I returned to the land was just amplified in beauty. Mm. It was just gorgeous.
Oh, I love that. Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Mary Norris, our guest on Radio Times today. We're going to be talking probably more about some of the things she is known for as her many years at as a copy editor at The New Yorker. In the meantime, we've been talking about her new book called Greek to Me, Adventures of the Comic Queen. And we did post some questions and comments on our Facebook page, and we'll get to those after this very short break. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Mary Norris. She's got a New Yorker web series, or this is a montage, I should say, from a New Yorker web series, The Comic Queen, which will give you an idea of the kind of topics that she has covered.
Hello. Today we're going to talk about one of my pet peeves, the word impact used as a verb, the overuse of the word massive, how to handle punctuation within and around parentheses, the difference between effect and effect, the difference between farther and further, that and which. Now we're going to tackle the dangling participle.
And Mary Norris, she has her hands over her face laughing, listening to herself. That's also a part of your life, right?
Yes, very much so. And even though I did retire from copy editing at The New Yorker a few years ago, once you have been dubbed the Comic Queen, you cannot escape it.
Right. Are you happy with that designation?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's nice to be remembered. It's nice to have a memorable designation. I have a couple of crowns, including a comma crown with aluminum commas dangling off of it. Yes, everyone envies that.
Well, you wrote in your previous book, the image of the copy editor is of someone who favors a rigid consistency, a mean person who enjoys pointing out other people's errors, a lowly person who is just starting out on her career in publishing and is eager to make an impression, or at worst, a bitter, thwarted person who wanted to be a writer, instead got stuck dotting the I's and crossing the T's and otherwise advancing the careers of other writers. I suppose I have been all these.
And I suppose I was all of those. I had an especially hard time when I was starting out on the copy desk and I was trying to write for Talk of the Town in The New Yorker. Mm-hmm. And if there was a week I'd submitted a story and it did not get accepted and somebody else's did, I could not help but feel envy. And I had to, mm-hmm. Of course, be professional and copy edit that other person's piece of work without rancor. And certainly not sabotage it. I wouldn't last long in the profession if I did that. So a lot of it was about controlling my envy.
Mm-hmm.
And also realizing that the only thing that would help was really getting published myself at some point. So I kept working at it and was very satisfying finally to get a whole book out of my day job.
There you go. Isn't there a God for envy to help us through?
Ah, wow. Who would be that? Probably Hera. hero was always jealousy, right, of Zeus's lovers. But I wouldn't take my cues from Hera, no.
Let me get see what Cletus from Bristol has to say. And Cletus, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Very, very good show, as always.
Thank you.
Ms. Nord, I have to get your book. I'm very, very glad that you're listening. Are you familiar? My name is Cletus, as Marty just said, and evidently the third pope, the third pope was named Anacletus, A-N-A-C-L-E-T, as in Tom, U.S., Anacletus. I'm proud to share that name. But I wonder where that prefix, if it is a prefix, or it was a prefix, came from, and if you're more familiar with Antigone, Thucydides, the historian, who else? Euripides, et cetera. Et al, I should say.
Et al, right.
Yeah, I hope that's right. The names. I'm going to get your book.
Sure.
I have to get your book. The names. Where are the names? From where do they spring, or the origin? Or
we hear you, Cletus. No, I appreciate the call.
Well, the name Cletus might be related to Heracles, that clay at the end of Heracles, that means glory. Cleopatra means glory of the father. Patroclus, I think that from the Iliad, that Kles at the end of his name. Also, in the T-U-S ending, that looks a little Latin to me. Not that I really am an expert in etymology, but I would guess that Cletus is from the same root as the Cles in Heracles, so you should be proud of that. The Anna at the beginning of it, in Greek, there's a word anabasis, which means up country. The word an, the prefix an, means up or perhaps the heights. So this would be an extra high form of glory.
There you go, Cletus. Enjoy that name. A Facebook comment from Margie says, I have a question about the semicolon. Can I just use two sentences?
Absolutely. Do use two sentences. This is what my advice would be, especially if you have any kind of insecurity about using a semicolon. It doesn't sound like you have any insecurity about that, because you know that what follows a semicolon needs to be able to stand alone as its own sentence. Otherwise, you don't need a semicolon. You need probably a comma.
Well, do we need a semicolon then?
The semicolon is a subtle thing that can actually be done without. It is a kind of a super comma and is useful in lists in which the items themselves already have commas, because then you can't distinguish that internal comma from the serial comma.
Right.
In sentences, Henry James is a master of the semicolon and uses it for great effect, to great effect. So if you're Henry James and you can do that and you can make, prose seem like a quartet in an opera simply by throwing in some semicolons, okay, do it. Otherwise, in plain English, really, it can be done without.
I rarely use a semicolon now that I think about it. Facebook comment from Evelyn, is there any agreement on how to punctuate short and long quotes on social media? Nesting quote marks is messy. I'm not sure what a nesting quote mark is, but social media has its own rules and regulations, it seems.
Yes, it does. Sometimes it does without quote marks, but you still attribute the quote with, say, a dash or a parentheses, as long as it's attributed. The nesting quotes, that's a quote within a quote. Single mark for the quote within the quote. And that does get messy, especially when you have this double quote right up against the single quote. And you can't. It just looks like three apostrophes.
It does. It does.
That can get a little bit messy. I don't know of any rules, I would say, that of all the media, Twitter is most open to innovation and to streamlining.
Are you okay with that?
I am okay with that, yes. If something is going to be published in a book form or a long form on the web, then it should be as carefully punctuated as anything in print.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. I'm sure this is said a million times, but the use of emojis in many ways is like hieroglyphics, right? I mean, it's this return to a kind of primitive way of expressing oneself. And I use them to my friends all think I'm crazy, but I use emojis because they're kind of playful and fun. And
they are playful and fun, and I've tried to use them. You know, I've looked around. I've shopped for the right emoji for me, and I've found a couple of things. I found the evil eye in Greek, the Greek flag. I found some little things that look like the Parthenon, you know, a temple. But what I've found where I stop, because my expression in language when I write, I tend to be understated. And that is not what emojis are for. You know, people use five of them at once.
Yes.
I can't do that.
You're a single emoji person.
That's right. I pack all the punch into one
into
emoji.
Into that one perfect emoji. A Facebook comment from Catherine. Me is a perfectly good word. Stop glossing up me by saying I, as in this is Patrick and I's. I don't quite understand this comment here.
I got that.
You got that? Okay, then go for it.
I mean, she's not yelling at me, this person. Right. The reason my book is called Between You and Me, that first book, was to help people get used to being able to say me. You know, you're taught when you're young, or we were back in the 50s and 60s, not to say me and Tommy are going to the store, but to say, put the other person first, say Tommy and I. I'm not strict at all about saying things like, well, me and Enzo are going to watch those kites tonight. That's fine. It's informal, right. Enzo and me. But what does bother me is when it should be me and somebody makes it I. It's overcorrection.
Oh, I got you.
And what this listener is referring to is sometimes it's the I is also being used instead of my or mine in a possessive construction, like Jeff and I's car instead of Jeff and my car. Jeff's and my car. It's that, and that is, I agree, barbaric. Mm-hmm.
Is barbaric. Facebook comment from Kristen, the comma splice has gotten out of control, even in newspapers, etc. It's lazy and so wrong, and it makes me crazy.
Well, that's the opposite problem from the person who doesn't want to use semicolons. These things should be made into their own sentences. There is a use. I don't know if that listener is familiar with Elena Ferrante's work, the great Neapolitan quartet. Her translator follows the Italian. There are lots of run-on sentences in it, and it's effective because it shows the rush that the language is coming out in. But this is something for the expert. Don't try this at home.
A Facebook comment from Julie, affect or effect? I never mastered that one. I rewrite the sentence. Are there rules sort of like principle and principle that sort of easy rules to remember that by?
Affect and effect are a little difficult because, well, affect is to influence someone. Mm-hmm. And an effect is the result of something. But you can also use effect as a verb to effect good communication. Mm-hmm. And you can also use affect as a noun, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody with little facial expression has no affect,
right? Exactly.
So they do get confusing. Just please don't substitute impact.
Is that the word or the misuse that rankles you the most?
Impact or? Instead of affect. Or influence is, as in, you know, it's a good word, impact, but it usually I think it should be reserved for, say, when an asteroid hits the Earth, and then that has an impact.
So then how do you feel about impactful?
Oh, I detest it. Not that there's anything I can do about it.
A Facebook comment from Lori. Does ending punctuation go inside or outside the parentheses?
Well, it depends. If the whole sentence is in the parentheses, if what's in the parentheses is a whole sentence that is followed, that has been preceded by a sentence with a period at the end of it, then the period goes inside the parentheses. If the parentheses is part of a bigger sentence, then the punctuation will go outside it, unless it's part of a quote. You can put a question mark inside the parentheses if what's in the parentheses is a question. This is a question that demands examples.
Right.
Right. And you'd want it to be visual.
so you could actually see,
right.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
see where everything goes. Facebook comment from John. This is actually one of the Radio Times producers. Says, my friends say things like there's a... My friends say things like, there's a whole half of the football game left. Can there be a whole half of something?
There can't be more than two halves of something. I tell you that. That's casual language. I think you can say that. You can say a whole nother deal, right. You know, instead of
so you can say whole half.
I think you can say whole half, yes.
It applies to football. The Oxford comma. You have said, I think it suggests care. It suggests someone who's structured and disciplined and not a slob, someone who's into detail, who likes precision, someone who has standards. There's a whole back and forth about the Oxford comma. I'm on the fence about it, I have to say.
Well, I'm glad to hear you're on the fence about it. Most people have a clear opinion and will not give it up for anything. And hearing you read that, I realize it sounds a little harsh. I mean, it doesn't mean that somebody who doesn't use the serial comma is a slob. That's not true. It's just that different publications have different styles. The New Yorker used the serial comma and always has.
Put it in a sentence just so our listeners know with the comma.
The easiest example is the flag is red, white, and blue. Without the serial comma, the flag is red, white, and blue. You know, I hear the difference there, and I like the serial comma. The reason for it, and I call it the serial comma, others call it the Oxford comma, is to prevent ambiguity. And in that sentence, it doesn't prevent ambiguity, and it's actually kind of hard to find an example of a sentence where it does prevent ambiguity, but they're out there.
Right.
And it's just easier to use it than not. But a publication that doesn't use it, the New York Times, doesn't use the serial comma, and it's more streamlined. It takes up less space.
Yes.
Now that it's online, I don't know why you would worry about taking up less space, but no matter. Anyway, the point is to be consistent. Mm. You know, if it does seem ambiguous, use the serial comma, and if it doesn't, it can be done without. It's not a moral issue. It's not a failing.
That is so good to know. We're almost out of time here, but I read, or maybe even wrote in your new book, Greek to Me, that driving a milk truck was your best job ever.
Oh, it was. It
better
was.
Than your years at the New Yorker?
Oh, yes. I got up early. I was out on the road in the milk truck before rush hour. You know, it wasn't that. I didn't have to get up at 3 in the morning, but I had to get up at 5 or 6. And it was independent. There was no one watching me. It was a sales job besides a driving job. And turns out that if you believe in what you're selling, it's really easy to sell things. Wow. And it's about relationships with people. I had lovely customers. And I just remember mornings in the winter being out, my truck being the first one to cut treads in the snow. And because the sun was low, I'd have a very skinny, long shadow. I liked having a long, thin shadow.
Oh, that's so great. Well, Mary Norris, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Well, thank you, Marty. It's been a pleasure to be here and in Philadelphia.
And in Philadelphia as well. And again, her new book is Greek to Me, Adventures of the Comma Queen. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out more about the program, how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and much, much more. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for all those questions and comments as well.